Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I recently sat down with a woman named Anita Sarkeesian. Sarkeesian is a critic and activist who gained notoriety after she posted a series of videos called Tropes versus Women in Video Games. I watched one of your videos. I've watched many of them, but one of them was about, there's no other way to put this, the centrality of the female butt.
Yes.
In video games.
Yeah.
And it was, I have to say, it's pretty astonishing.
Video game designers often choose to put tremendous focus on the butts of certain characters while going to almost absurd lengths to avoid calling attention to the butts of others. Third-person games with female protagonists typically display those characters in a way that gives players a full-body view. A classic example of this is the original Tomb Raider games, which are presented from a third-person perspective wherein protagonist Lara Croft's entire body is visible. In these early Tomb Raider games, Lara's butt is typically right in the center of the screen.
The videos provide a solid feminist, but I have to say, hardly radical critique to video games. And yet, a portion of the gamer community went absolutely nuclear. Anita Sarkeesian became the target of a sustained campaign of hatred. There were threats of violence and even death. There were terrible invasions of her privacy, and you probably heard of this as Gamergate, which went from being a dust-up in the gaming community to a huge national news story about the safety of women online. All because Sarkeesian dared to point out the obvious. Like this business with butts.
So you might never have noticed that until I said, hey, look at how many times this happens. And you're like, oh, yeah. Like, I've seen it, but I never stopped to think about how frequently women's butts are on display in video games or other media or whatever it is, whatever the pattern is, right?
So much so that they're dead center in the screen. I mean, there's a strategy for their display, and the male butt is conceived by as many leather raincoats as humanly possible.
My favorite way that men's butts are covered is with just a piece of tattered fabric.
I'm glad that you have a favorite.
It is my favorite. You have to find the humor in a video where you're literally spending hours and hours looking at video game characters' butts.
It's your original plan to be an academic and write a 300, 400-page book on these kind of patterns?
No.
What was the original plan?
It wasn't. I actually went to grad school to get my master's degree because I wanted to teach. And when I started doing Feminist Frequency, I was like, well, that's what I want to do. I want to do this activism. And this was just the avenue that I made an impact in. And so this is where I'm at. Mm. Video games were always a part of what I did because I was always looking at popular culture. And so when I decided to do a new series—
Were you a gamer kid?
I was, yeah.
And what did you play?
I played a lot of Nintendo when I was like 5. I started playing Super Mario Brothers and Super Mario World, and I was obsessed with my Game Boy, and so that was really my gaming foundation. I played a lot of random PC games. I don't know where they came from. They just sort of showed up, and some of them were super sexist. Like, I don't understand why I was allowed to play them.
What were the early ones that were super sexist?
The one that comes to mind is this it's kind of obscure game called Vinyl Goddess from Mars, and it was just— she was wearing this tiny, skimpy outfit, and she made, like, erotic noises when she jumped, and, like, her movements were really sexualized.
And it gets worse from there, no?
Yeah. I mean, gaming has had a huge, long history of being incredibly problematic.
But in all seriousness, you're accumulating the evidence of sexism and extreme sexism in these video games. The reaction online could not have been something you expected. It was extraordinary. Can you describe it?
I decided to do the series Tropes versus Women in Video Games. We launched a very modest Kickstarter to help fund the series. I was asking for $6,000 for 5 videos. And when I announced the series to my fan base, I was descended upon by a cyber mob. It was a organized, concerted effort to destroy me. Everything from death threats and rape threats, misogynist slurs. This is across all of my social media, my email, my website. There were successful efforts to knock my website offline. They would send pizzas to addresses that they thought were mine with extra sausage because they think that's funny.
Got that.
Yeah. They would take efforts to dox me, which is to find and distribute your personal information, like your home address and phone number, social security number, that sort of thing. It went on and on. They sent letters to the IRS and the FBI to investigate me. My email, my, like,
literally everywhere that you exist online, imagine having the most horrific, hateful messages sent to you every day through all of those different
forms. And you tried to communicate with the executives of Twitter, for example, and they refused to do anything about it.
Well, no. I have been in communication and have done consulting work with most of the major social media sites. When I first met with Twitter 4 years ago, I was like, oh, well, they're not going to do anything. To today, where they actually have a security council and they have symposiums and they bring in experts to consult with them. You know, how fast they're moving and what they're doing is up for debate, but they are making some effort to actually do something
about
their
platform. But as I understand it, your case, in a sense, was a pivotal case, or one of a number of pivotal cases having to do with the absolutist view, a free speech absolutist view, everything goes, versus a hate speech view, a kind of American versus European view of speech. What did it make you feel about, not the emotional question, but how, to what degree this kind of speech should be monitored and controlled on social media?
Well, I think that is bringing up a sort of false dichotomy about what's actually happening, right? And part of the problem is that harassment and, like, hatred of women is being framed as a free speech issue. Telling someone that you're going to kill them is not a free speech issue.
It certainly is not.
That is not protected under free speech. So, one, the internet is very confused about what free speech actually is. The other thing is that most of the social media outlets are also proponents of free speech, and they want to make their platforms available for that purpose. And what my work is to say, you need to protect your users because we are being attacked. And what's actually happening is our freedom of speech is being taken away because they're trying to silence us so that I can't speak up about video games. I can't speak up about online harassment, et cetera, right? So if we want to talk about freedom of speech, we talk about who's not getting to talk.
I can't help but ask you this, Anita. What was the effect on you as a human being on this? It sounds, at the very best, exhausting to soft sell it, and it's got to be a lot worse than that.
Exhausting is a good word. I am perpetually tired.
And it hasn't stopped?
No, God, no. It's been 4 years of nonstop harassment. And I don't see that ending unless I disappeared off the internet completely, which I'm not about to do.
Do you feel that you made a positive impact? Do you think despite all the harassment, all the pain endured as a result of that work, that somehow, some way, you made an inroad? Can you feel it? Do you sense it? Is it palpable?
Yes. I don't think I could continue doing the work if I didn't have that sense. And that's, you know, I'm hedging a little bit when I say that, because I think that in a very real way, my story coupled with many other women's stories of being harassed, for example, really propelled harassment into the main stage, right? It was covered by major outlets. It was covered by The New Yorker. It was on the front page of The New York Times. Like, these are reputable outlets talking about, like, how online harassment is a problem. And so there is a larger conversation, and I don't think that the social media sites would have ever reached out to us to improve their platforms if that hadn't happened, if there wasn't this critical mass around it.
The commitment to your work and the commitment to the themes of your work politically seem unabated. So you're working now on a new series called Ordinary Women, Daring to Defy History, and that's going to come out in the fall. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I'm super excited about this new project. We're taking the stories of five women who have been mostly written out of history in a lot of ways and just retelling their stories to a new audience. You know, one of the problems is that, like, history is written mostly by men, and they kind of write out all of these women. So we're not getting these stories in history books.
Who are the women?
We are talking about Murasaki Shikibu, who wrote the first novel, which who thinks about the first novel ever being written, but that was a thing that happened. Ida B. Wells, who is an investigative journalist. Emma Goldman, who was, I don't even know how to describe her because she's just so multifaceted, but she was just, like, committed her life to social justice. Jing Shi was a feared pirate leader in the late 18th century, early 19th century in China. She commanded a fleet of about 60,000 pirates. And then the last one is Ada Lovelace, who was the first computer programmer.
So I know it's a work in progress, but we're going to go to a clip from your new video series.
When most people think of pirates, they imagine hulking, fearsome men with names like Blackbeard or Long John Silver. Although the vast majority of pirates throughout history have been male, one of the most famous and feared pirates who ever lived was Jing Shi, a young Cantonese woman who became the ruler of one of the largest pirate fleets in history and the mastermind behind a floating criminal empire so powerful that even the Chinese military couldn't stop it.
So these are not all goody-goodies.
No, I mean, that was...
So Xingxi is nobody's idea of a hero of humanity.
Correct. And that was a very intentional choice. So one of the things...
A badass at best.
Yes. No, she was terrifying. Yeah. Like, she's
a...
I mean, she
a
was...
A killer!
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was really...
So why do you want us to... In with the heroes, like Ida B. Wells, why do you want to tell the story of a killer? Because you want to... Women could be awful. Women could be horrible, too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, for
yeah.
real. Because, yeah. you know, when we talk about representations of women and improving the representations, it's not, like, making them all heroes and perfect. Like, I don't think... I'm certainly not asking for that. I want to see complex, flawed women who are heroic and villainous and boring and, you know, like, we are humans too, and we have all of the range of human traits available. And so putting Xingxi into this category of women was really important to me because I wanted to show, like, we are multifaceted and we've done great things and horrible things, and why isn't her name up there with, like, Blackbeard when we talk about pirates?
Did examples like this give you, I don't know, psychic support while you were going through this prolonged crisis?
That's an interesting question. Maybe to some degree. I don't know if consciously, but there's always this sense of, you know, I'm not alone. You know, like, I'm not the only one doing this work. I'm not the first one to do it. I won't be the last one to do it. The other thing is that, you know, like, would I do this again? Yes, absolutely. Not because I like the harassment or I want it, but because it's important work. I think the one thing I would have changed is I would have used a pseudonym.
Game critic Anita Sarkeesian. Her new video series is called Ordinary Women, Daring to Defy History.